I would absolutely recommend the vaccine to anybody who can get it. There is absolutely no reason in the world to avoid a vaccine, especially if you have dementia. There's recent data that's emerging that shows that this disease, coronavirus and COVID, affects old people the worst, of course. We know that mortality increases from 40s, it's minimal, 50s, it's minimal, ticks up in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. It really escalates. People with Alzheimer's disease are about that age.
At Rumor Living Senior Living Broadcast, we are proud to be a part of a group of extraordinary industry leaders who are working toward a stronger society and a better future for older adults. Here, we have conversations that identify challenges and opportunities to enhance the baby boomers, the parents, and the grandparents' lives. We hope that you enjoy these conversations. We believe their ideas will expand perspectives and encourages more people to join our efforts. So please let us know your thoughts, and I invite you to be a part of the conversation.
Dr. David Wiseman, he is the founder of the Clinical Trial Center at Abington Neurological Associates. With multiple clinical trials on mild cognitive impairment and Alzheimer under his belt, he has become a leading AD trialist nationwide. So David has devoted his research career to advancing new therapies for Alzheimer disease, and his trial center also has advancements in strokes, MS, and Parkinson's disease. David, thank you so much for joining me today in Boomer Living.
Yep.
So can we start by distinguishing between Alzheimer disease and other cognitive impairments like memory loss, senility, and dementia?
Alzheimer's disease is a specific dementia. I use the analogy, it's a type of dementia. The way that a rose is a type of flower. Okay. There are many different types of flowers, but in this case, we're talking about a rose is the type, and dementia is the big umbrella word that encompasses a lot of other problems. A dementia is almost a vacuous word. It means having a thinking problem that makes one unable to carry on their previous day-to-day life. Okay. That could be the case if you're hitting the head really hard and get a traumatic brain injury. Knock on wood. Okay. You could have a traumatic brain injury and you could be justifiably called having a dementia. It would be a static dementia. Alzheimer's disease is the dementing illness that, first of all, causes the most dementia. Up to 80% of all dementing cases are Alzheimer's disease. And it's due to proteins that build up in the brain and they start affecting memory mostly, but sometimes other cognitive functions. And it slowly gets worse. And that's what Alzheimer's disease is. So we can distinguish that pretty easily clinically and predict those proteins in about 80 to 90% of the cases.
How is Alzheimer's, say, diagnosis? And then has this method of diagnosis changed at all over the last several years?
So the diagnosis is just like anything else in medicine. When you go to your doctor with an earache, they listen to the story, which ear hurts, how long has it been going on, what are you even doing, have you been swimming? The doctor elicits a history, sometimes things you're not even aware of, what kind of Q-tips you use to clean your ear. And you may find that information germane or not germane. They take a history and then they do an examination, they look in the ear. Same thing with Alzheimer's disease. Typically, people are presenting with memory loss or the caregiver is presenting with memory loss. There's a history. When did it start? How bad is it? Then they do an examination. Instead of looking in an ear, they are doing a cognitive evaluation. Here are some words. Try to remember them while I distract you. What were those words? Draw this thing right here, which is these pentagons. And problems with that can lead to a diagnosis. And that diagnosis is very good. It's not entirely firm. It's not the pathology, but it does predict those proteins, like I said. Now, recently, the change in diagnosis has been the advent of what we call biomarkers for this disease. So imaging techniques to measure those proteins, and they are being layered in to the normal history and examination to increase the probability that we're talking about Alzheimer's disease. as defined by having those proteins. And those are PET scans and lumbar punctures. Those are mostly, almost entirely being done for clinical trials now, because we really want to make sure that we're studying the appropriate population to get into these trials. So for clinical use, it's really just the history and an examination usually suffices. But that may change with the advent of disease-modifying therapies that look like they may be on the horizon now.
Can you tell us about the Philadelphia cognitive exam, the computerized screening system to diagnose and detect dementia that you invented and validated? Now, what impact has that made on people with dementia?
It is a substitute for many other tests, many other cognitive tests. The only trick of this is that it's digital. It's on an iPad. And so physicians can bill for it. It was designed to really try to increase utilization of a test, to increase diagnosis and disclosures of diagnosis. Because that's one of the underbellies of Alzheimer's disease, that it's not disclosed and it's not diagnosed. Why? Well, in part because physicians are not only not incentivized, but they're de-incentivized to diagnose Alzheimer's disease. It's a hard diagnosis to make. What happens when they diagnose this? Tons of questions take time. So you can see every reason in the world, there's a lot of headwinds for the diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. And we know that people are living with Alzheimer's disease and about only half of them are diagnosed. And of those diagnosed, if you ask the caregiver, the doctor diagnosed Alzheimer's disease, what did they tell you? They didn't say Alzheimer's disease, nor did they say a dementia. They use the other euphemisms that you've alluded to before, senility, old age, we called it memory loss. And I see that a lot. So this Philadelphia Cognitive Exam, or PCOG, it was designed to try to get at that. And I have to say, it did not work.
Could you elaborate on that? It did not work?
Doctors still don't use it. They are not testing. They are not diagnosing and not disclosing. I think it's just one solution to a huge problem of disclosure and diagnosis within any memory and thinking problem. That said, we just try our best every day to raise awareness of the disease so that if there is memory loss or thinking problems, going to a doctor and eventually getting referred to a doctor with some specialization, some expertise can really help.
Absolutely. So what research are you currently working on surrounding Alzheimer?
Alzheimer's disease is thought to be extremely druggable, even though there is no drug yet. Those proteins I alluded to before, they build up in the brain 20 years before the onset of any memory or thinking problems. And so we think that we can get rid of them with a variety of therapies. And currently there are 4 drugs that are in development that all basically do that. There's a lot of good data to show that they remove this protein called beta amyloid and get it out of the brain. The way that they do that, they target it for removal by the immune system. With these antibodies have been in the news a lot. We make antibodies to pathogens like the coronavirus. We can measure them. But when we give people antibodies, we can actually make them in a vat and give people antibodies and make them attack the protein, not the COVID, not another pathogen, but make them bind to and stick to amyloid. And then the natural immune system clears it out. It's pretty amazing. And that has been shown that we can do that now with these medications. People have the amyloid with a positive PET scan and they convert to negative. And the first time that was shown, that was like astounding, like a beautiful data. We didn't know that impacts cognition yet. And we still don't know that fully, but it does look like there's a lot of silver linings here that even though there have been a lot of negative drug trials, looks like getting rid of beta amyloid does slow down the disease. And that's now been shown, again, 4 drugs in development and 3 have basically shown it in a phase 2 or phase 3 study.
That's great. Now, how did you manage doing clinical trials during the pandemic? Did you have to put your research on pause or simply change how it looks?
We changed a lot. So during the beginning of the pandemic, it was actually about a year ago that we started getting really concerned about this. We didn't know how the virus spread. We had no clue what was going on. And in these clinical trials, usually trial integrity and patient well-being are exactly the same thing. What's good for the trial is good for the patient. They're getting a drug or a placebo, but either way, they're getting a shot at something. They get a lot of safety things. But here in the pandemic, trial integrity and patient well-being were not agreeing. They were almost adversarial ideas. Patient safety coming in for a trial where they could get exposed to a novel coronavirus, where they have high susceptibility of mortality. We knew always that coronavirus affects older people the worst. And Alzheimer's disease is a disease of aging. So people who are older are our trial participants. So the way that we handled it, obviously we kept everything very clean. We scrubbed things between patients and everyone wore a mask, always on site. And that's still the case. But it was also an individual conversation with trial participants. We did not even consider stopping the trials. The trials are important. We have obligations to science. We have obligations to the sponsor. We have obligations to the subjects. So that was off the table. We had to continue. We have to get this data. That is a grand, I cannot imagine the pandemic that would have to occur for us to stop. I mean, it would have to be a societal breakdown, frankly. So we kept going. We didn't enroll anymore. We didn't enroll anybody new into a trial. And we put all new trials on hold. But the people that we had, we kept them going as safe as we could. And again, it was an individual decision, an individual conversation with each participant. Do you want to continue? Do you want to hold off? Can you come in? Do you feel safe? What's your caregiver health? Who else do you live with in the house? Maybe they're susceptible. You may not want to because everybody's individual situation is different. I live with my in-laws who actually got COVID and gave it to me. But that was on the other hand. We can't have people living with susceptible people. It's a public health problem. They can't come in and feel like they're endangering their entire family. So some people went on a hiatus. I'm pleased to say most people made it through and kept going.
Yeah, it has impacted everyone in the globe in some form or another, economics, health, relationships. So I'm very optimistic with the vaccine being available, rolling out, and our economy to consistently stay open. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. My heart breaks for like people like bar owners and restaurateurs and creatives. That's just horrible. The suffering that they've had to endure has been unbelievable, economic suffering. And then my heart breaks for the people who went out to those restaurants and took a risk and got coronavirus and died.
Yeah. Now, what's the biggest findings that you've uncovered in your Alzheimer research?
I think the biggest finding is yet to come. The biggest finding will be a disease-modifying therapy that slows down the progression of Alzheimer's disease and keeps it mild. There's no reason why these people, why someone with Alzheimer's disease needs to progress. We think that we can slow it down to a glacier pace, but we have not proven it.
What about your research makes you most optimistic about the future of Alzheimer's diagnosis or treatment?
I think we're finally getting the appropriate people into these trials with the protein at the right stage of the disease and treating them appropriately with the right target, the right drug, and the right dose. That just seems so intuitive. But it is a massive discovery process that takes years and has taken many dozens of years since 1980s when we discovered that these proteins collect in the brain.
Now, you founded a research center and now you conduct research outside an academic center. So can you explain the difference between the two and I guess why did you do it that way?
Academic places are huge, enormous institutions. And if you like that, then that's great, okay? But there's a huge institutional overhead, red tape, people looking over your shoulder, and it's clunky. It's harder to get things done. You call people and they don't have an answer. They don't have decision rights. You can't find someone with decision rights within a huge institution. So I didn't like any of that. And when I was at a big institution, I thought, you could do this outside. And I'm very fortunate. I went into private practice and I started doing these clinical trials and I was the right person at the right time. And I started doing one and it took off. We showed our mettle and now we get more. And that is wonderful. And we're bringing these trials to my, at my site, to this population here. So it's been a terrific ride. And I'm very happy with what we've accomplished outside a big institution. And it's a little bit more rare. It's been done before. There are standalone sites in the private practices that do clinical trials, but it's usually someone who came from academia first and got fed up with the big institution and left. And that's our story, but I just started doing research right out of fellowship.
Congrats. Congrats on your journey and your success.
Thank
now,
you.
Now, would you recommend the vaccines to people with Alzheimer, dementia, or other cognitive impairments? And are there special side effects that we should keep an eye on?
I would absolutely recommend the vaccine to anybody who can get it. There is absolutely no reason in the world to avoid a vaccine, especially if you have dementia. There's recent data that's emerging that shows that this disease, coronavirus and COVID, affects old people the worst, of course. We know that mortality increases from 40s, it's minimal, 50s, it's minimal, ticks up in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. It really escalates. People with Alzheimer's disease are about that age. They are older because we know that at 65, 1% of the population has it, but then Alzheimer's doubles every 5 years. So again, it's a disease of aging, but it does look like preliminary data shows that dementia itself may be a risk factor for added mortality and morbidity from the coronavirus. Now, who knows why that is, right? That could be because they're living in a nursing home and they get their first exposure of coronavirus, maybe more. Okay, maybe they're more bedbound, maybe they have more comorbidities, but it does look like a marker for worse disease. So should anyone with dementia get the vaccine? Yes, any human should get this vaccine. The vaccine safety profile is unbelievably good, unbelievably good. They've now given millions of doses with very few reactions and very few that we can actually attribute to a vaccine. Meanwhile, the vaccines are performing way better than expected. Their reduction of severe disease is incredible. Yes, please, if vaccine is available to you, if you're vaccine hesitant, that's totally normal. Let me just put that one out there as well. I am hesitant when I step into a plane because I'm a nervous flyer. Do be hesitant, but know that it's totally safe. Get the vaccine.
Thank you. Great. Now, what advice would you give to a younger version of yourself, someone who's interested in doing research?
I have to tailor that advice to the person I was. It has to be like a key that kind of gets into your brain. So that's the trick of advice, is actually to give good advice at that time so the person can actually hear it, right?
Yeah.
For myself, I think what I needed to hear was that people are good in three levels. They're good with people, they're smart, and they're hardworking. If you're smart and hardworking, you tend to blow off the other one. If you're good with people, you may ease off on your diligence. You can get away with it. People are going to give you a pass, right? So usually people are not like all three wheels. And I wish someone had really put it in front of me that try to make friends, because I definitely erred on the hard work, being diligent, being smart. And I thought that was the way to be good. To be good with people was to be smart. That turns out to be false. That was a mistake that I had when I was young. I wish I could have heard that it's better to make friends with everybody, to never burn a bridge, to never come across as anything other than a nice person. I still struggle with that.
Well, I'll make sure I'll give those advice to my children, especially my daughter, who's going to be starting medical school. So thank you for that advice.
Three things. And most people, two come naturally, and they can work on the third. And very few people only have one. Mm-hmm. Think of it like a tricycle. Very few people are unicyclists.
That's true. Very good. Now, what do you think is your biggest strength that enables you to have a unique, impactful effect on older adults or adults with dementia?
When I look around at other people who can try to do what I do, there's a lot of front-end work explaining the disease state in a clear and kind manner. That is a strength of mine, I believe. And I'm also extremely diligent on email, timely. I get things back. I also credit my staff. I have been extremely lucky with hiring good people. And if you surround yourself with good people on a good team and you yourself are like pretty good, then success will follow. So I think that's why we've been so successful.
Great. Congratulations on your success and also your dedication in this area is much needed. Do you have anything else that you would like to share?
No, I think we covered so much. Good luck to your daughter.
Yeah. Oh, I'm so excited. Yeah.
Where is she going to go?
Michigan. Yeah. And what I'm so excited is that we're near. I'm from Michigan.
What's your daughter going to do? Did she know what she's going to specialize in?
I think here's the thing. Here's what I advise to her. Whatever you do, just make sure you'll be paying off your student loan. She has some interest. She's really not made a decision yet. From what I understand, the 4 years, it's medical school, and then you go into a specialty, and then you go into your residency. Let me ask you, do people typically know before going into medical school, or do they discover that during medical school?
Some know.
Oh, really?
Some, very few, I would say. Mm-hmm. Some people, their father's an orthopedic surgeon, and they're like, if I like orthopedic surgery, I'm definitely going to do it because I've just grown up with it. And that's great if they can do that and cultivating trust early. I didn't have that. I had no clue. I was just along for the ride. And I discovered neurology like my second and third year. So okay. I think that's true. Most people, they have to go in undifferentiated. They have to be interested in everything. And then they discover what they want and who their tribe is. And the best advice is just look, it's a long process. You don't have to make an instantaneous decision. You will find your way. And if you don't, there's still room for you. You can stay undifferentiated. You can go into internal medicine. You can go into family practice and be very undifferentiated and then focus on something. Yeah. Alternatively, people come in hyper-competitive and they're like, dermatology for me, plastic surgery, orthopedic surgery, ophthalmology, anesthesiology, whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah. I do know that during her undergraduate, she was under cardiology, vascular department at Michigan, and she did a lot of research. So she had several publications in that area. So I thought maybe that would be an area of interest. I think she feels very blessed to have that opportunity.
Yeah.
But she's interested. She's doing a lot of volunteer in the geriatrics right now because of COVID. And they don't have visitors unless you go in there. And so she's enjoying that part and doing some volunteers and, of course, tracking. That's a big area. They need people to be tracking folks with COVID. But it's good to know she did tell me that's decreasing. Thank God for that. So I think she's exploring.
Yeah, that's the way to go. That's where I mean, I think we're going to graduate a bunch of infectious disease people. I mean, there's so many doctors who got into COVID, like deep into infectious disease. So who knows? That could be the wave of the future. But good luck to her.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
All right. Wonderful. You take care.
Bye-bye now.
If you enjoy the podcast, please take a moment to rate and review Boomer Living, Senior Living Broadcast, wherever you get your podcasts. One of my favorite things is to hear from you, the listener. So please leave a review and let us know what you think. And I read all of the reviews. Also, please pass it along, your friends, family, coworkers, and anyone aging. So please leave a review and I love to hear from you.